From the viewpoint of the concepts we have emphasized in this chapter, Einstein's equation gives us the most concrete explanation for the central fact that nothing can travel faster than light speed. You may have wondered, for instance, why we can't take some object, a muon, say, that an accelerator has boosted up to 667 million miles per hour, 99.5% of light speed, and push it a bit harder, getting it to 99.9% of light speed, and then really push it harder, impelling it to cross the light speed barrier. Einstein's formula explains why such efforts will never succeed. The faster something moves, the more energy it has, and from Einstein's formula, we see that the more energy something has, the more massive it becomes. Muons traveling at 99.9% of light speed, for example, weigh a lot more than their stationary cousins. In fact, they are about 22 times as heavy, literally. But the more massive an object is, the harder it is to increase its speed. Pushing a child on a bicycle is one thing. Pushing a Mack truck is quite another. So, as a muon moves more quickly, it gets ever more difficult to further increase its speed. At 99.999% of light speed, the mass of a muon has increased by a factor of 224. At 99.9999999% of light speed, it has increased by a factor of more than 70,000. Since the mass of the muon increases without limit as its speed approaches that of light, it would require a push with an infinite amount of energy to reach or to cross the light barrier. This, of course, is impossible, and hence, absolutely nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. As we shall see in the next chapter, this conclusion plants the seeds for the second major conflict faced by physics during the past century, and ultimately spells doom for another venerable and cherished theory, Newton's universal theory of gravity. Chapter 3. Of Warps and Ripples. Through special relativity, Einstein resolved the conflict between the age-old intuition about motion and the constancy of the speed of light. In short, the solution is that our intuition is wrong. It is informed by motion that typically is extremely slow compared to the speed of light, and such low speeds obscure the true character of space and time. Special relativity reveals their nature and shows them to differ radically from previous conceptions. Tinkering with our understanding of the foundations of space and time, though, was no small undertaking. Einstein soon realized that of the numerous reverberations following from the revelations of special relativity, one was especially profound. The dictum that nothing can outrun light proves to be incompatible with Newton's revered universal theory of gravity, proposed in the latter half of the 17th century. And so, while resolving one conflict, special relativity gave rise to another. After a decade of intense, sometimes tormented study, Einstein resolved the dilemma with his general theory of relativity. In this theory, Einstein once again revolutionized our understanding of space and time by showing that they warp and distort to communicate the force of gravity. Newton's view of gravity. Isaac Newton, born in 1642 in Lincolnshire, England, changed the face of scientific research by bringing the full force of mathematics to the service of physical inquiry. Newton's was such a monumental intellect that, for example, when he found that the mathematics required for some of his investigations did not exist, he invented it. Nearly three centuries would pass before the world would host a comparable scientific genius. Of Newton's numerous profound insights into the workings of the universe, the one that primarily concerns us here is his universal theory of gravity. The force of gravity pervades everyday life. It keeps us and all of the objects around us fixed to the Earth's surface. It keeps the air we breathe from escaping to outer space. It keeps the moon in orbit around the Earth, and it keeps the Earth bound in orbit around the sun. Gravity dictates the rhythm of the cosmic dance that is tirelessly and meticulously executed by billions upon billions of cosmic inhabitants, from asteroids to planets to stars to galaxies. More than 3 centuries of Newton's influence causes us to take for granted that a single force, gravity, is responsible for this wealth of terrestrial and extraterrestrial happenings. But before Newton, there was no understanding that an apple falling to Earth from a tree bore witness to the same physical principle that keeps the planets revolving around the sun. With an audacious step in the service of scientific hegemony, Newton united the physics governing both heaven and earth and declared the force of gravity to be the invisible hand at work in each realm. Newton's view of gravity might be called the great equalizer. He declared that absolutely everything exerts an attractive gravitational force on absolutely everything else. Regardless of physical composition, everything exerts as well as feels the force of gravity. Based on a close study of Johannes Kepler's analysis of planetary motion, Newton deduced that the strength of the gravitational attraction between two bodies depends on precisely 2 things, the amount of stuff composing each of the bodies and the distance between them. Stuff means matter. This comprises the total number of protons, neutrons, and electrons, which in turn determines the mass of the object. Newton's universal theory of gravity asserts that the strength of attraction between two objects is larger for larger mass objects and smaller for smaller mass objects. It also asserts that the strength of attraction is larger for smaller separations between the objects and smaller for larger separations. Newton went much further than this qualitative description and wrote down equations that quantitatively describe the strength of the gravitational force between two objects. In words, these equations state that the gravitational force between two bodies is proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. This law of gravity can be used to predict the motion of planets and comets around the sun, the moon about the Earth, and rockets heading off for planetary explorations, as well as more earthbound applications, such as baseballs flying through the air and divers spiraling poolward from springboards. The agreement between the predictions and the actual observed motion of such objects is spectacular. This success gave Newton's theory unequivocal support until the early part of the 20th century. Einstein's discovery of special relativity, however, raised what proved to be an insurmountable obstacle for Newton's theory. The incompatibility of Newtonian gravity and special relativity. A central feature of special relativity is the absolute speed barrier set by light. It is important to realize that this limit applies not only to material objects, but also to signals and influences of any kind. There is simply no way to communicate information or a disturbance from one place to another at faster than light speed. Of course, the world is full of ways for transmitting disturbances at slower than the speed of light. Your speech and all other sounds, for example, are carried by vibrations that travel at about 700 miles per hour through air, a feeble rate compared with light's 670 million miles per hour. This speed difference becomes obvious when you watch a baseball game from seats that are far from home plate. When a batter hits the ball, the sound reaches you moments after you see the ball being hit. A similar thing happens in a thunderstorm. Although lightning and thunder are produced simultaneously, you see the lightning before hearing the thunder. Again, this reflects the substantial speed difference between light and sound. The success of special relativity informs us that the reverse situation, in which some signal reaches us before the light it emits, is just not possible. Nothing outruns photons. Here's the rub. In Newton's theory of gravity, one body exerts a gravitational pull on another with a strength determined solely by the mass of the objects involved and the magnitude of their separation. The strength has nothing to do with how long the objects have been in each other's presence. This means that if their mass or their separation should change, the objects will, according to Newton, immediately feel a change in their mutual gravitational attraction. For instance, Newton's theory of gravity claims that if the Sun were suddenly to explode, the Earth, some 93 million miles away, would instantaneously suffer a departure from its usual elliptical orbit. Even though it would take light from the explosion 8 minutes to travel from the Sun to the Earth, in Newton's theory, knowledge that the Sun had exploded would be instantaneously transmitted to the Earth through the sudden change in the gravitational force governing its motion. This conclusion is in direct conflict with special relativity, since the latter ensures that no information can be transmitted faster than the speed of light. Instantaneous transmission violates this precept maximally. In the early part of the 20th century, therefore, Einstein realized that the tremendously successful Newtonian theory of gravity was in conflict with his special theory of relativity. Confident in the veracity of special relativity and notwithstanding the mountain of experimental support for Newton's theory, Einstein sought a new theory of gravity compatible with special relativity. This ultimately led him to the discovery of general relativity, in which the character of space and time again went through a remarkable transformation. Einstein's happiest thought. Even before the discovery of special relativity, Newton's theory of gravity was lacking in one important respect. Although it can be used to make highly accurate predictions about how objects will move under the influence of gravity, it offers no insight into what gravity is. That is, how is it that two bodies that are physically separate from each other, possibly hundreds of millions of miles apart, if not more, nonetheless influence each other's motion? By what means does gravity execute its mission? This is a problem of which Newton himself was well aware. In his own words, "It is inconceivable that inanimate brute matter should, without the mediation of something else, which is not material, operate upon and affect other matter without mutual contact. That gravity should be innate, inherent, and essential to matter so that one body may act upon another at a distance through a vacuum without the mediation of anything else, by and through which their action and force may be conveyed from one to another, is to me so great an absurdity that I believe no man who has in philosophical matters a competent faculty of thinking can ever fall into it. Gravity must be caused by an agent acting constantly according to certain laws, but whether this agent be material or immaterial, I have left to the consideration of my readers." That is, Newton accepted the existence of gravity and went on to develop equations that accurately describe its effects, but he never offered any insight into how it actually works. He gave the world an owner's manual for gravity which delineated how to use it, instructions that physicists, astronomers, and engineers have exploited successfully to plot the course of rockets to the Moon, Mars, and other planets in the solar system, to predict solar and lunar eclipses, to predict the motion of comets, and so on. But he left the inner workings, the contents of the black box of gravity, a complete mystery. When you use your CD player or your personal computer, you may find yourself in a similar state of ignorance regarding how it works internally. So long as you know how to operate the equipment, neither you nor anyone else needs to know how it accomplishes the tasks you set for it. But if your CD player or personal computer breaks, its repair relies crucially on knowledge of its internal workings. Similarly, Einstein realized that hundreds of years of experimental confirmation notwithstanding, special relativity implied that in some subtle way Newton's theory was broken, and that its repair required coming to grips with the question of the true and full nature of gravity. In 1907, while pondering these issues at his desk in the patent office in Bern, Switzerland, Einstein had the central insight that, through fits and starts, would eventually lead him to a radically new theory of gravity, an approach that would not merely fill in the gap in Newton's theory, but rather would completely reformulate thinking about gravity and, of utmost importance, would do so in a manner fully consistent with special relativity. The insight Einstein had is relevant for a question that may have troubled you in Chapter 2. There we emphasized that we were interested in understanding how the world appears to individuals undergoing constant velocity relative motion. By carefully comparing the observations of such individuals, we found some dramatic implications for the nature of space and time. But what about individuals who are experiencing accelerated motion? The observations of such individuals will be more complicated to analyze than those of constant velocity observers, whose motion is more serene, but nevertheless, we can ask whether there is some way of taming this complexity and bringing accelerated motion squarely into our newfound understanding of space and time. Einstein's happiest thought showed how to do so. To understand his insight, imagine the year is 2050. You are the FBI's chief explosives expert, and you have just received a frantic call to investigate what appears to be a sophisticated bomb planted in the heart of Washington, D.C. After rushing to the scene and examining the device, your worst nightmare is confirmed. The bomb is nuclear and of such powerful design that even if it were buried deep in the Earth's crust or submerged in an ocean's depth, the damage from its blast would be devastating. After gingerly studying the bomb's detonation mechanism, you realize that there is no hope to disarm it, and, furthermore, you see that it has a novel booby-trap feature. The bomb is mounted on a scale. Should the reading on the scale deviate from its present value by more than 50%, the bomb will detonate. According to the timing mechanism, you see that you have but 1 week and counting. The fate of millions of people rests on your shoulders. What do you do? Well, having determined that there is no safe place anywhere on or in the Earth to detonate the device, you appear to have only one option. You must launch the device into the depths of outer space where its explosion will cause no damage. You present this idea to a meeting of your team at the FBI, and almost immediately your plan is dashed by a young assistant. "There is a serious problem with your plan," your assistant Isaac begins. "As the device gets farther from the Earth, its weight will decrease, since its gravitational attraction with the Earth will diminish. This means that the reading on the scale inside the device will decrease, causing detonation well before reaching the safety of deep space." Before you have time to fully contemplate this criticism, another young assistant pipes up. "In fact, come to think of it, there is even another problem," your assistant Albert says. "This problem is as important as Isaac's objection, but somewhat more subtle, so bear with me as I explain it." Wanting a moment to think through Isaac's objection, you try to hush Albert, but as usual, once he begins, there is no stopping him. "In order to launch the device into outer space, we will have to mount it on a rocket. As the rocket accelerates upward in order to penetrate outer space, the reading on the scale will increase, again causing the device to detonate prematurely. You see, the base of the bomb, which rests on the scale, will push harder on the scale than when the device is at rest, in the same way that your body is squeezed back into the seat of an accelerating car. The bomb will squeeze the scale just as your back squeezes the cushion in the car seat. When a scale is squeezed, of course, its reading increases, and this will cause the bomb to detonate if the resulting increase is more than 50%. You thank Albert for his comment, but having tuned out his explanation to mentally confirm Isaac's remark, you dejectedly proclaim that it takes only one fatal blow to kill an idea, and Isaac's obviously correct observation has definitively done that. Feeling somewhat hopeless, you ask for new suggestions. At that moment, Albert has a stunning revelation. "On second thought," he continues, "I do not think that your idea is dead at all. Isaac's observation that gravity diminishes as the device is lifted into space means that the reading on the scale will go down, My observation that the upward acceleration of the rocket will cause the device to push harder against the scale means that the reading will go up. Taken together, this means that if we carefully adjust the precise moment-to-moment acceleration of the rocket as it moves upward, these two effects can cancel each other out. Specifically, in the early stages of liftoff, when the rocket still feels the full force of the Earth's gravity, it can accelerate, just not too severely, so that we stay within the 50% window. As the rocket gets farther and farther from the Earth, and therefore feels the Earth's gravity less and less, we need to increase its upward acceleration to compensate. The increase in the reading from upward acceleration can exactly equal the decrease in the reading from the diminishing gravitational attraction. So, in fact, we can keep the actual reading on the scale from changing at all. Albert's suggestion slowly begins to make sense. In other words, you respond, an upward acceleration can provide a stand-in or a substitute for gravity. We can imitate the effect of gravity through suitably accelerated motion. Exactly, responds Albert. So, you continue, we can launch the bomb into space, and by judiciously adjusting the acceleration of the rocket, we can ensure that the reading on the scale does not change, thus avoiding detonation until it is a safe distance from the Earth. And so by playing off gravity and accelerated motion, using the precision of 21st century rocket science, you are able to stave off disaster. The recognition that gravity and accelerated motion are profoundly interwoven is the key insight that Einstein had one happy day in the Bern Patent Office. Although the bomb experience highlights the essence of his idea, it is worth rephrasing it in a framework closer to that of Chapter 2. For this purpose, recall that if you are put into a sealed, windowless compartment that is not accelerating, there is no way for you to determine your speed. The compartment looks the same, and any experiments you do yield identical results regardless of how fast you are moving. More fundamentally, without outside benchmarks for comparison, there is no way that a velocity can even be assigned to your state of motion. On the other hand, if you are accelerating, then even with your perceptions limited to the confines of your sealed compartment, you will feel a force on your body. For instance, if your forward-facing chair is bolted to the floor and your compartment is being accelerated forward, you will feel the force of your seat on your back, just as with the car described by Albert. Similarly, if your compartment is being accelerated upward, you will feel the force of the floor on your feet. Einstein's realization was that within the confines of your tiny compartment, you will not be able to distinguish these accelerated situations from ones without acceleration, but with gravity. When their magnitudes are judiciously adjusted, the force you feel from a gravitational field or from accelerated motion are indistinguishable. If your compartment is placidly sitting upright on the Earth's surface, you will feel the familiar force of the floor on your feet. Just as in the scenario of upward acceleration, this is exactly the same equivalence Albert exploited in his solution for launching the terrorist bomb into space. If your compartment is resting on its back end, you will feel the force of your seat on your back, preventing you from falling, just as when you are accelerating horizontally. Einstein called the indistinguishability between accelerated motion and gravity the equivalence principle. It plays a central role in general relativity. This description shows that general relativity finishes a job initiated by special relativity. Through its principle of relativity, the special theory of relativity declares a democracy of observational vantage points. The laws of physics appear identical to all observers undergoing constant velocity motion. But this is limited democracy indeed, for it excludes an enormous number of other viewpoints, those of individuals who are accelerating. Einstein's 1907 insight now shows us how to embrace all points of view, constant velocity and accelerating, within one egalitarian framework. Since there is no difference between an accelerated vantage point without a gravitational field and a non-accelerated vantage point with a gravitational field, we can invoke the latter perspective and declare that all observers, regardless of their state of motion, may proclaim that they are stationary and the rest of the world is moving by them, so long as they include a suitable gravitational field in the description of their own surroundings. In this sense, through the inclusion of gravity, general relativity ensures that all possible observational vantage points are on equal footing. As we shall see later, this means that distinctions between observers in Chapter 2 that relied on accelerated motion, as when George chased after Gracie by turning on his jetpack and aged less than she, admit an equivalent description without acceleration, but with gravity. This deep connection between gravity and accelerated motion is certainly a remarkable realization. But why did it make Einstein so happy? The reason, simply put, is that gravity is mysterious. It is a grand force permeating the life of the cosmos, but it is elusive and ethereal. On the other hand, accelerated motion, although somewhat more complicated than constant velocity motion, is concrete and tangible. By finding a fundamental link between the two, Einstein realized that he could use his understanding of motion as a powerful tool toward gaining a similar understanding of gravity. Putting this strategy into practice was no small task, even for the genius of Einstein, but ultimately this approach bore the fruit of general relativity. Achieving this end required that Einstein forge a second link in the chain uniting gravity and accelerated motion, the curvature of space and time, to which we now turn. Acceleration and the warping of space and time. Einstein worked on the problem of understanding gravity with extreme, almost obsessive intensity. About 5 years after his happy revelation in the Bern Patent Office, he wrote to the physicist Arnold Sommerfeld, "I am now working exclusively on the gravity problem. One thing is certain, that never in my life have I tormented myself anything like this. Compared to this problem, the original, i.e. special, relativity theory is child's play." He appears to have made the next key breakthrough, a simple yet subtle consequence of applying special relativity to the link between gravity and accelerated motion in 1912. To understand this step in Einstein's reasoning, it is easiest to focus, as apparently he did, on a particular example of accelerated motion. Recall that an object is accelerating if either the speed or the direction of its motion changes. For simplicity, we will focus on accelerated motion in which only the direction of our object's motion changes while its speed stays fixed. Specifically, we consider motion in a circle such as what one experiences on the tornado ride in an amusement park. In case you have never tested the stability of your constitution on this ride, you stand with your back against the inside of a circular plexiglass structure that spins at a high speed. Like all accelerated motion, you can feel this motion. You feel your body being pulled radially away from the ride's center, and you feel the circular wall of plexiglass pressing on your back, keeping you moving in a circle. In fact, although not relevant for the present discussion, the spinning motion pins your body to the plexiglass with such a force that when the ledge on which you are standing drops away, you do not slip downward. If the ride is extremely smooth and you close your eyes, the pressure of the ride on your back, like the support of a bed, can almost make you feel that you are lying down. The almost comes from the fact that you still feel ordinary vertical gravity, so your brain cannot be fully fooled. But if you were to ride the tornado in outer space, and if it were to spin at just the right rate, it would feel just like lying in a stationary bed on Earth. Moreover, were you to get up and walk along the interior of the spinning plexiglass, your feet would press against it just as they do against an earthbound floor. In fact, space stations are designed to spin in this manner to create an artificial feeling of gravity in outer space. Having used the accelerated motion of the spinning tornado to imitate gravity, we can now follow Einstein and set out to see how space and time appear to someone on the ride. His reasoning, adapted to this situation, went as follows. We stationary observers can easily measure the circumference and the radius of the spinning ride. For instance, to measure the circumference, we can carefully lay out a ruler, head to tail, alongside the ride's spinning girth. For its radius, we can similarly use the head-to-tail method, working our way from the central axle of the ride to its outer rim. As we anticipate from high school geometry, we find that their ratio is 2 times the number pi, about 6.28, just as it is for any circle drawn on a flat sheet of paper. But what do things look like from the perspective of someone on the ride itself? To find out, we ask Slim and Jim, who are currently enjoying a spin on the tornado, to take a few measurements for us. We toss one of our rulers to Slim, who sets out to measure the circumference of the ride, and another to Jim, who sets out to measure the radius. To get the clearest perspective, let's imagine a bird's-eye view of the ride. As Slim begins to measure the circumference, he is going to get a different answer than we did. As he lays the ruler out along the circumference, we notice that the ruler's length is shortened. This is nothing but the Lorentz contraction discussed in Chapter 2, in which the length of an object appears shortened along the direction of its motion. A shorter ruler means that he will have to lay it out, head to tail, more times to traverse the whole circumference. Since he still considers the ruler to be 1 foot long, since there is no relative motion between Slim and his ruler, he perceives it as having its usual length of 1 foot. This means that Slim will measure a longer circumference than did we. What about the radius? Well, Jim also uses the head-to-tail method to find the length of a radial strut, and from our bird's-eye view, we see that he is going to find the same answer as we did. The reason is that the ruler is not pointing along the instantaneous direction of the motion of the ride, as it is when measuring the circumference. Instead, it is pointed at a 90-degree angle to the motion, and therefore it is not contracted along its length. Jim will therefore find exactly the same radial length as we did. But now, when Jim and Slim calculate the ratio of the circumference of the ride to its radius, they will get a number that is larger than our answer of 2 times pi, since the circumference is longer but the radius is the same. This is weird. How in the world can something in the shape of a circle violate the ancient Greek realization that for any circle, this ratio is exactly 2 times pi? Here is Einstein's explanation. The ancient Greek result holds true for circles drawn on a flat surface. But just as the warped or curved mirrors in an amusement park funhouse distort the normal spatial relationships of your reflection, if a circle is drawn on a warped or curved surface, its usual spatial relationships will also be distorted. The ratio of its circumference to its radius will generally not be 2 times pi. For instance, let's compare three circles whose radii are identical, yet their circumferences are not the same. The circumference of a circle drawn on the curved surface of a sphere is less than the circumference of a circle drawn on a flat surface, even though they have the same radius. The curved nature of the sphere's surface causes the radial lines of the circle to converge toward each other slightly, resulting in a small decrease in the circle's circumference. The circumference of a circle drawn on a curved surface, a saddle shape, is greater than that drawn on a flat surface. The curved nature of the saddle's surface causes the radial lines of the circle to splay outward from each other slightly, resulting in a small increase in the circle's circumference. These observations imply that the ratio of the circumference to the radius of a circle on the sphere will be less than 2 times pi, while the same ratio of a circle drawn on a saddle shape will be greater than 2 times pi. But this deviation from 2 times pi especially the larger value of the circle drawn on a saddle shape, is just what we found for the spinning tornado ride. This led Einstein to propose an idea, the curving of space, as an explanation for the violation of ordinary Euclidean geometry. The flat geometry of the Greeks, taught to schoolchildren for thousands of years, simply does not apply to someone on the spinning ride.